Welcome. In this segment, we're going to be talking about abuse over the lifespan. It's just, you know, you could do a whole course on this, so it's going to be feel like just ridiculously quick overview. But I think it's a really helpful journey. Actually, one of my main recommendations, however, is that if you have not already done so, I suggest pausing this video and going back to the links on the Moodle page to the website that talks about different kinds of abuse in different stages of life, and at least get kind of an overview of the flow of things. And actually best to just let that seep in for a day or two if that's possible. You'll start to notice connections between different kinds of abuse that may not have occurred to you. One of the biggest problems in this whole discipline is the fact that different kinds of abuse, I think, get siloized into different disciplines. So, this is certainly a factor in the professional community, where people who are engaged in work in the area of sexual abuse don't necessarily talk to the people or interact with the people working on domestic violence and so on, and it's just an enormous failure to communicate among people who are fundamentally working on the same sort of problem, just reflected at different stages of the life cycle. Okay, there's no way that I'm going to cover in depth any single kind of abuse in this presentation. In the next part of this class, weeks 3 and 4, we'll try to dig a little deeper and look closely at 4 different kinds of abuse. We'll look at incest and self-harm and spiritual abuse for sure, so that you get some sense of what stuff starts to feel like when you get a little bit deeper into things. But today, just some big picture overview comments about different stages of the life cycle. I think it's really painful just to say the expression prenatal abuse. But there are certainly a lot of behaviors that sure look, feel like abuse that involved fetuses getting harmed. The two largest that I'm going to mention have to do first with, both have to do with what I call chemical abuse, use of chemicals to harm others. There's some chemical abuse in other stages of life, certainly some forms of hazing that involve exposure to lethal doses of alcohol is a form of chemical abuse. During pregnancy, the largest of these forms of chemical abuse is exposure to tobacco. Let me read you the conclusion of one of the larger and most respected studies about this. Children's exposure to tobacco constituents during fetal development and via environmental tobacco smoke exposure is perhaps the most ubiquitous and hazardous of children's environmental exposures. A large literature lists both prenatal maternal smoking and children's environmental tobacco smoke exposure to decreased lung growth, increased rates of respiratory tract infections, otitis media, ear problems, and childhood asthma, with the severity of these problems increasing with increased exposure, sudden infant death syndrome, behavioral problems, neurocognitive decrements, and increased rates of adolescent smoking are also associated with such exposures. So here's an enormously harmful environmental exposure. Now I can mention this, I can pick this of all that long list off on the website of prenatal abuse for a couple reasons. One is it's probably the largest problem. But also because it emphasizes the link between abuse and addiction. It's one of those things that doesn't always get talked about enough, but addiction plays a very prominent role in many different kinds of abuse, from domestic violence to sexual abuse. There's lots of kinds of abuse where the addictive process is just there waiting to be observed. And often I think, even though I teach a class both on addictions and a class on abuse, that often it feels to me like we're talking about the same thing. Now, just as an aside, I think it's worth noting that occasionally the public and the media will pay attention to a kind of chemical abuse of fetuses. And the best example is sort of crack baby stuff in the late 80s and in the 90s. It was very, very common to see reports in the media about crack babies, infants exposed in utero to moms who smoked crack. And it turns out, after this and time to do the science, that neonatal exposure to cocaine in any form doesn't seem to be particularly harmful to developing fetuses. Here's a review article summary. After controlling for exposure to tobacco and alcohol, there is no evidence for specific effects of prenatal cocaine use on physical growth and development. Tobacco exposure is far more detrimental to fetal development. So in terms of the well-being of a fetus, smoking tobacco is in all probability far more harmful than smoking cocaine. Now, I'm not suggesting that if you have a choice, pick cocaine. Neither exposure is a good idea. But the question that I think this raises is, why is it that neonatal exposure to cocaine was such a big deal in public consciousness, whereas neonatal exposure to tobacco is still not really, I think, very firmly grounded in public consciousness? There may be a variety of reasons for that. I think the fact that most of the newspaper articles and media articles about crack babies always showed African American moms might be a factor in why those stories made the news, but there's probably other factors than race involved as well. But it's an example of how public perceptions of a particular kind of abuse aren't always very well informed by the information that's available. It's also true that after exposure to tobacco products, it's certainly the case that alcohol exposure is the next largest risk factor for neonates. Fetal alcohol syndrome, or it's increasingly being called fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, to emphasize that a range of outcomes possible, is in a birth defect, to use a very generic kind of term, which involves permanent brain damage, irreversible brain damage, caused by prenatal exposure to alcohol. It is the leading cause of preventable mental retardation and birth defects in the United States. It's the leading cause of preventable mental retardation. Affects as many as 1 in 100 live births. It creates problems that you do not outgrow. They last a lifetime. They're hardwired into brain structure. And they're not genetic disorders. They're not sort of, something that was in the genes. They're directly caused by exposure to alcohol. Now, the problem with doing something about this largely has to do with the drinking culture in the United States, particularly the extent to which binge drinking is part of drinking culture in the United States. This chart shows for the period 2002 to 2007, binge alcohol use by pregnancy trimester. Women who are not pregnant, have no child, but are within childbearing age, a little bit more than 30% of those people binge drink. So a third of the female population of childbearing age binge drinks. I think their definition was 4 more drinks in 1 drinking session, something like that. And the drinking during first trimester goes down to only 8%, but it still means 8% of women who are pregnant in their first trimester are continuing to binge drink. 8%. That's a lot of people. And, if you binge drink, and you become pregnant, You know, I know there are some women who know they're pregnant the next morning. There are other women who don't notice until they miss a couple periods. So you may not even know that you're pregnant. In order to change your drinking patterns, and so the growing fetus will be exposed to very high levels of alcohol, sufficient to cause lifelong brain damage, but before you even know that you're pregnant. Now, I suppose it's good news that binge drinking by pregnant moms goes down during trimesters, but that figure of 8% of all women binge drink during their first trimester is a very troubling reality. It results in, you know, thousands and thousands of brain damaged kids every year. It's also troubling if you look at the figures from later trimesters. By the time a woman has an 18-month-old, roughly 20% of women are back up to binge drinking, which has its own sort of problems in terms of maternal maturity and the ability to be helpful to kids and all of that. So there's a number of kinds of chemical abuse of neonates, and it's a pretty serious problem. We could spend a lot more time here. I'm just going to force myself to keep moving on. Let's talk about child abuse. Stuff changes when you get to childhood. Even quite early, an emerging problem of sexual abuse of very, very young children. It's not as common as sexual abuse of children at a little older age, but it does happen. And you have lots of violence in the home kinds of issues. And look at the long list of the long and relatively painful list on the website of issues that sometimes seem like different issues, but when you see them all together, you observe some continuity. I thought the one I'd talk about, because I think it's controversial in the Christian context, is the issue of spanking and use of physical pain as a parenting strategy. Let me just give you my own personal conclusion, which you don't have to. This will not be on the quiz. You don't have to agree with me about this. There are no quizzes. Is that the use of physical pain as a parenting strategy is always inappropriate. It's always harmful. It always does more harm than good. It's always counterproductive. Now, you can call me an extremist if you want, but let me just suggest a couple things. First is that there is now a fairly large body of evidence to suggest that physical discipline of children increase that child's long-term risks for substance abuse and other mental health issues. This slide is just a summary statement from a fairly large study in Canada. And here's their conclusion. Data from this Ontario community survey indicate that retrospective self-reports of slapping or spanking during childhood are common, and that there's a linear association between the reported frequency of these experiences and lifetime prevalence of psychiatric disorder. The association is weak for major depression and anxiety, and stronger for alcohol abuse or dependence and externalizing problems. So I think there's a quite good body of evidence. This is just one example of a study suggesting that one of the things you can do to increase your child's risk of becoming substance dependent in adolescence or later in life is to use physical pain as a parenting strategy. Now, if you work with parents, or you're thinking about your own parenting strategies if you have kids, I assure you I understand the appeal of physical discipline as a parenting strategy. It is a very effective way to ensure compliance on the part of young kids. And it's very difficult to remember, I think, in the real world on a day-to-day basis, that compliance is not your primary goal in kids. It may be what's most responsive to your needs right now, but it may not be what's most responsive to their needs. which is developing the capacity to, handle difficult emotional situations or problems in life, learning to think through things for themselves and so on. And if you just want compliant, good kids, physical pain might seem very appealing, but the evidence, I think, is really quite substantial that in settling for compliance, you do some significant long-term harm to kids. Now, just a couple other comments about why parents, let's stipulate that right now we're talking about parents who love their kids, want the best for their kids, are doing things that they think the Bible tells them to do. Why people might actually use, when there are dozens of parenting strategies available to be tried, why they would gravitate towards a parenting strategy involving physical violence, physical pain. I've never talked to anybody who used physical violence and physical pain as a parenting strategy who, when I asked them, what other parenting strategies have you tried, could list more than a couple. It's like, we tried this. Often it's just, we tried threatening violence and that didn't work, and so now we're using violence. Advocates of such parenting strategies, of course, will give you a very long and coherent list of constraints on the kind of pain and the kind of violence, how much and under what conditions. You shouldn't be angry. It should be, there's lots of ways in which they will say, how to minimize the long-term harm of this, all of which is fine and again appropriate if you're going to use physical violence and physical pain as a parenting strategy. You would want to have some guidelines like that. In the real world, that might be a particularly helpful for a healthy family system. If, however, you're dealing with mom and dad who are raised in violent families themselves, constraining violence might be a much more complicated matter than simply offering people some guidelines. Finally, about this, let me show you the results of what I think was a very compelling study on parental depression and the physical discipline of children. This team did a study on dads and the sorts of things dads did with their kids and whether dad was depressed or not. The dark columns are behaviors engaged in by non-depressed dads, and the gray columns are behaviors engaged in by depressed fathers. So both depressed fathers and non-depressed fathers played games with their kids, 90%+ of them. In both cases, and both of them, 75%, in both populations, sing songs with their kids. Depression seemed to decrease the capacity of depressed fathers to read stories with their kids. It goes down from 58% to 41%. But notice the enormous impact on the amount of spanking that takes place. 13% of non-depressed fathers spank their kids, but 41% of depressed fathers spank their kids. Now, this suggests that the problem that results in event of spanking may, in fact, have nothing to do with the behavior of the child or the needs of the child at all. The person who needs correction and help and guidance and support, maybe the dad who's so depressed that he can't function, can't use parenting strategies that require more energy perhaps, more patience, more cognitive functioning than simply spanking. I encourage you to sort of keep that in the back of your mind, that people who use physical violence, physical pain as a parenting strategy are at, I think, extremely high risk of doing long-term harm to their kids. and that the person who needs help, the kid certainly needs to be protected if at all possible. But the best thing you might be able to do for families like this is to help the mom and dad see why it is that they find themselves stuck in this place, that they don't see other options. They can't list eight other parenting strategies that could be tried instead of physical violence. And so, all right, a bit of a rant. I think you got a sense of my views about that. Adolescence. Abuse, like lots of stuff in adolescence, gets really weird. I mean, adolescence is this new life stage created by the quite dramatic extension of life expectancies in the West, well, in the world as a whole. Life expectancy for the average American male at the beginning of the 20th century was 48 years. Now we're pushing into the 80s, so you have this enormous expansion in life, opening up these sort of transitional stages of life that we don't quite, haven't really had enough time to figure out what this is supposed to be like. And so you find all kinds of weirdness. In the most prominent feature of adolescence in terms of abuse is that it's much harder to recognize abuse of adolescence than to recognize abuse of children. There's a bunch of reasons for this. If a kid is acting out or engaged in high-risk behaviors as a result of abuse, not an uncommon response to abuse, it may just seem developmentally normal. Right? It may just seem, well, adolescents take risks and do crazy things, and maybe it's just about normal. You know, let's not bug him about this because he's just being the way adolescents are. And what happens is that you don't see it. You don't see the abuse because it gets swamped out by the perception that these sorts of behaviors are normal. Adolescents tend to be stigmatized as victimizers rather than victims. I'm not going to rant about this, but this is a very real effect, the presumption that what did he do wrong today? That adolescents are not, you know, wonderful, generous, contributing members of society when things are going well, but that they're always at risk of hurting other people. So we kind of lead with the suspicion towards adolescents. We don't know what they're up to. They're not talking to us as much as they used to. Something must be wrong with them. And so we don't tend to lead in these conversations with the perception that they might be victims. We lead with the fear that they might be abusers. This just says the same thing. Developmental changes are happening rapidly, and changes due to abuse may be under the radar for caregivers. So some withdrawal might be understood to be an appropriate part of adolescence, but the withdrawal subsequent to abuse might just be under the radar. You won't notice it. It's also true that one of the risk factors for adolescents is that they have parents in midlife typically, and the sort of stresses and strains of midlife and sort of sandwich generation kinds of things where you're caring for your parents and for your kids is an enormously stressful part of life. There's lots of crises and some distractions that are part of that. And so the needs of one's kids might take backstage to one's own struggling to stay sane and sober, or the needs to take care of one's own parents and other kinds of stresses and train, career stresses and all of that. Finally, parents might feel that being less attentive to their children in adolescence is developmentally appropriate. After all, we construe adolescence as a time, I think quite inappropriately, but we tend to construe adolescence as a time when kids should need their parents less. Now, I think that is just a profoundly misguided notion. Kids and adolescents need their parents differently, but they still need their parents. We need our parents in every stage of life. You know, if we had healthy parents in every stage of life, it would just be such a wonderful blessing. Some people have that, most of us don't. And so the need to stay engaged with one's kids during adolescence is critically important, but I think we tend to hesitate as if they're supposed to be taking care of things by themselves, or they'll never quite mature out of adolescence if they can't struggle on their own. Those those kinds of considerations. Now, just one complication to this that I point out, this is really getting into la-la land here, but my thoughts about this come from an incident you may or may not remember. It was 2005, I think. A woman named Sylvia Ann Johnson, a 40-year-old from Colorado, pled guilty to 9 felony and 2 misdemeanor charges that arose from parties she threw for high school kids in 2003 and 2004. At the parties, she not only bought booze for the underage boys, friends of her son, she also had sex with 5 of them. Okay, clearly just wildly inappropriate, out of control behavior. But I was very interested at the response in the media to this. And just here's one example. I could give some, but this is Tucker Carlson, who had a show, I can't remember what channel it was on, the situation with Tucker Carlson. His comment on this: I think she's a pretty cool mom, actually. I mean, he said that. Nationally syndicated TV show. I think she's a pretty cool mom, actually. And he goes on, no, but she's not. Look, some of these are 17-year-old boys. She's not making other people afraid to go out at night. I'm not saying she ought not to be punished. I'm merely saying, get a little perspective. Violent criminals, the ones who attack strangers, are the ones who cause society to disintegrate. Not Mrs. Johnson, who is clearly just a little baddie. Now, this same instinct that really, some of these 17-year-old boys, get a little perspective. Another way of saying that, and that I heard at the time, was these kids got lucky. You know? Now, if a father of a high school girl invited her friends over for parties at their house and bought them alcohol and had sex with 5 of them, we'd be asking, you know, which body parts should be cut off and where should this person spend the rest of their life? You know, there wouldn't be any doubt about that, but you get this enormous gender specificity to our instinctual response to abuse of adolescents. For women, for adolescent-aged women, the response is protective, it's outrage. For the response to adolescent boys who have been sexually abused by an older adult, the response is very confused. These kids got lucky. And, you know, there's something very, very dark at work there about male sexuality. The whole notion of getting lucky, if you think about it at all, I think means, you know, your sexuality is so disgusting that you're never really going to be able to have sex with anybody unless you get lucky, right? You have to get a break, because in the natural normal course of things, you're just way too disgusting sexual partner to anybody. It's an incredibly negative message. But I think if you listen to the sort of male macho radio culture in the U.S. at the time, you would have heard this same message. So it's really impossible to sexually abuse adolescent boys. And I think that represents, as a culture, a profound abandonment of adolescent boys. And it's deeply rooted in a loathing of male sexuality that's part of our part of the air that we breathe in our culture. Very troubling. And again, you wind up unable to see sexual abuse for what it is. You can see it for girls, but you can't see it for boys. Very strange. Very strange, I think. Now, in adulthood, things change again, and this is way too big a territory to be talking about in detail. I'll just make a comment about domestic violence. But please look at the sections on rape and marital rape and other kinds of things that start to emerge in adulthood. The statistics on domestic violence in the United States are very troubling. The statistics on domestic violence on the planet as a whole are equally troubling. One in four women in the United States will experience domestic violence during her lifetime. One in four women. If you're pastoring a congregation of 200 people, you have 100 women, there are probably 25 women in your congregation who will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. So when you're doing audience analysis in preparation for preaching and asking yourself, who am I preaching to here? I'd suggest that one of the things you might want to consider introducing upon occasion is the fact that 25% of the women in your congregation are going to experience some form of domestic violence during their lifetime. You would not hesitate to do that, I think, if it were other issues with less stigma to it. If you knew that 25% of the people in your congregation had cancer, you'd be talking about it all the time, right? You'd be preaching about it. You'd probably have a support group for people recently diagnosed with cancer and a support group for people in long-term treatment, you know, actively engaged in chemotherapy or other kinds of treatment. Have a support strategy for them. And you might have a support strategy for people in long-term recovery from cancer. You'd be using it as examples in your sermons and so on, simply because that's the life that people are engaged in. If you develop a capacity to see the collective trauma of abuse in your congregation, you'll be doing the same kinds of things. You'll just naturally, I think, say, you know, as an example of this point in the text, I just want to point out that, you know, one out of four of the women in our congregation will probably experience domestic violence, and a surprising number of men as well. Now, I just want you to know that the text envisions that, and that God is prepared to be helpful in situations like that. By far, the most victims of domestic violence, the most frequently cited number is 85%, are women. But that means there's 15% of men, and in all probability, a dramatically underreported 15% of the domestic violent cases are men. There's a lot more social stigma for a man reporting being beaten by his wife than for a woman reporting being beaten by her husband. There's also substantially less resources for men who are hurt in domestically violent relationships. Okay, a little bit about abuse in older adults. There's typically four kinds of abuse. There's more than that, but there's four kind of classes. The first is abuse by care-providing relatives. This is the classic granny battering situation. Caring for a senior adult, a mom or a dad who may be frail, unable to care for themselves in many ways, can be absolutely exhausting. I've done this myself, and it is. You sort of eventually acquire some caregiver fatigue. You know, it's just exhausting, and that exhaustion has an impact on the things you say, the way you behave. It's possible. And, of course, many of us caring for parents may be caring for people who have been emotionally abusive to us for a good share of our lifetimes. And we're kind of having to navigate that, observing that that we haven't experienced as much healing as we had hoped in this situation, because under stress, that stuff kind of floats to the top again. And I find it easy to imagine myself. How relationships with one's parents late in their life can become very troubled. And in extreme situations, you wind up getting parents that have been physically beaten or taken advantage of in a variety of ways, taken advantage of economically, treated with verbal abuse, with emotional abuse, and spiritual abuse, and many other kinds of abuse. Second kind of abuse common in a senior population is nursing home abuse. We, as a culture, have not made the decision to invest significantly and value senior care. And so there's the vast majority of caring facilities for senior citizens in the United States can't afford to hire the kind of staff or provide the kind of training that staff could use to help them be more effective in providing quality care. It's an industry which has a very noble calling, in my view, and along with a very explicit biblical foundation. And yet we don't seem as a culture to be able to really provide the economic resources to do that, I think, as well as it is possible to do. You can look at other cultures who do this much better than we do. And, you know, if you have a lot of money, you can buy quality care. But I'm concerned here about the norm, the average. And I think there's lots of abuse that emerges for lack of the ability to provide the kind of oversight that is needed for the industry. A third kind of abuse that's very common is just spouse abuse grown old. It's just all of a sudden in a community living situation, you see stuff that's been there all along. It's they've been able to hide it out at home. So mom moves into a retirement home and dad comes to visit, and or dad lives there too, and there's physical problems. This may just be what it looks like later in life. It's been going on, it may have gone on for 50 years, for 60 years, whether emotional abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, all kinds of abuse can just age out. Finally, it's worth noting that there is a significant amount of abuse of aging caregivers by elderly care recipients. Requires some explanation. If you have a 70-year-old who's the primary care provider for her 95-year-old mom, and the 70-year-old is, let's just hypothetically imagine a situation in which the 70-year-old has been emotionally abused by her mom for most of her life, is experiencing all the long-term trauma, the accumulated trauma of that, still at 70 years, and has never gotten to the level where she's been kind of forced to get help for herself about it. So it's just all these accumulated resentments that are stashed away inside of her and have been festering away for 70 years. And now she's the primary care provider for the person who abused her all these years. And there's a risk there that the 70-year-old will get tired of being in the role of the abused person and switch to the role of the abuser. But there's also the risk that the abuse will just keep going, that the 90-year-old mom will continue to emotionally abuse her 70-year-old child. I've seen this more than once, where you just see a continuation again of the sort of family roles that have been the norm in the history of this relationship. If mom has always been abusive to her daughter, she may be abusive to her daughter all the way to the end. And you may not have noticed that in earlier stages of life. But here, when living sometimes is in a more social environment, you start to see stuff you might not otherwise see. Then just a brief heads up. This is kind of dated now, but dated from the late 80s and 90s, suggesting that reports of elder abuse is increasing. I think this probably continues, whether this is because there's more elder abuse or not, or whether we're taking it more seriously as an issue, is, I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that yet, but it seems like it's a growing problem. Okay, some conclusions about this Worldwind survey, a very selective survey. There isn't any period in life that's free from the potential of abuse. It's not abuse is not just child abuse. It's prenatal abuse, child abuse, adolescent, young adult, senior citizen. Every stage of life has the potential for abuse, and sometimes abuse starting prenatally continues all the way through senior citizen. It just becomes the like water to a fish to people. What this means is that the lifetime risk of abuse is much higher than the risk of experiencing abuse in any one stage of life. And it also means that the impact of abuse is cumulative. And this is a particularly important point. It is that often in a pastoral role, someone will come to you and they'll be talking about something in your antenna for abuse. Your alarm system for abuse starts going off. You say, I think that's what's going on here. And you need probably to have somewhere within you the sensibility that this particular experience of abuse may not be an isolated experience of abuse. Someone who experienced, neglect as an infant and bullying as a child and hazing in college and date rape as a young adult now is talking about another experience of abuse. And all of that, the trail leads back to all those things. It's rare to find someone where you have, certainly happens, but in most cases, all these things get connected inside of us. And when you first start to get help, it's this kind of messy, undifferentiated, steaming pile of mess. And that takes quite a while to kind of sort out what's about this, what's about this, and so on. Very complicated process. A few issues I'd like you to think about. I'd like you to actually go back over those pages on the website about different life stages and sort of ask a few questions. And these are things that we can talk about in the forums as well. The first has to do with whether your instincts about the characteristics of perpetrators change when you think about different kinds of abuse. The sort of instinctual sensibility about child sex abuse, the perpetrators of child sexual abuse, certain images come to mind, certain characteristics of that person who does that. How does that compare with your instincts about the abuser in granny battering or date rape or incest? I mean, are there differences there? My suspicion is that if you take some time to sit down with that and look at that, you'll notice really quite a range of different instincts about what perpetrators are like. And that, I think, is a very helpful thing to notice. So you're not locked into the notion that perpetrators of abuse are a certain kind of person. I'll talk about this more in our next presentation, but go back and look at the different kinds of abuse and ask yourself, what do perpetrators look like? Do the same thing about your instincts about the characteristics of abused persons. I think we all carry about with us some assumptions about people who experience rape. Now, the evidence suggests that there's no common characteristic to people who experience rape. Anyone can get raped. But we still carry about with us different assumptions about the kind of people who get harmed, the kind of kids who get hurt, the kind of people who are victimized. And ask yourself whether there's differences in the stuff you bring, the assumptions you make about the kind of people who get abused, and whether that changes when you look at different kinds of abuse. I think you'll get a sense that this is a much more complicated question than our initial assumptions might give to us. Third issue that would be interesting to talk about has to do with the fragmentation I mentioned earlier, the siloization of these problems. And the question is it easier to not see 20 small problems? Well, not that any of these problems are small problems, but it's easier to see 20 things and just way too painful to see this as a big problem. Now, I think myself that it's clearly a big problem. And the question is, how can we get ourselves to back up a little bit so we see the big picture about this, rather than hide ourselves from it? And part of that issue, not really a different issue, has to do with whether all these different kinds of abuse are really part of the same problem. If they're part of the same problem, are there some themes about this? And boy, there's just a wide range of different instincts about this. For some people, the organizing theme that clarifies all kinds of abuse is violence. That's what's at the root of everything. For others, it's trauma that seems to be what connects all these different forms of abuse and helps clarify things. For others, it's gender. For others, it's power and the abuse of power that's really at the heart of things. And I think it'd be worth some self-reflection about that. I'm not going to answer that for you. Say, well, the answer is the abuse of power. I think it's very much more complicated than that. But I do think it'd be worth asking yourself at this time when we're looking at kind of a big overview of many different kinds of abuse. Are there things that seem to you like the connecting themes through all this? And it's not at all important when you come up with the kinds of themes that would make most sense to me, but I think it is helpful to sort of notice themes. It's possible that there are three or four different organizing themes. Okay, then just a final provocation, really. It's a provocation. It's this: if public policy choices and decisions about funding priorities can change the incidence of a form of abuse, does that mean that we are to some extent collectively responsible for the abuse that actually occurs? Again, it's a rhetorical question in many ways. I think it's indisputable that public policy about abuse of different kinds has an effect on the incidence. And so there's very difficult for us to find, I think, high moral ground here when we are all, in a certain sense, involved in the brokenness that abuse speaks to, or that is the source of abusive behaviors. And I think that's one of the more troubling conclusions about looking at all these different forms of abuse. Is that we are part of the water. We're not apart from it, looking at sort of strangers who are doing weird. Well, there's this very deep instinct in us to treat people who abuse others and to treat people who have been abused by others as other, as not us. This is a very instinctive, self-protective gesture. I don't want this to really be about me in any way. And this last provocation is to ask you to think about that a bit. Is it really possible to make this about other people? I know for some of you it's transparently obvious that there's no way to make this about other people. This is different ways of talking about the narrative of your life. It is certainly true for me. I'm unable to talk about this stuff as if it's just about other people. This is one of the core narrative themes of my life story. It has to do with abuse of various kinds. But there's still within us, I think, even when we know that, the tendency to sort of try to keep things off there at a safe distance somehow. Process that a bit when you look at these different kinds of abuse. And I look forward, I think we should have some pretty interesting discussions in the forum about this stuff. We can dig deeper into a particular kind of abuse if you want. We can talk about any of the issues that I've talked about here at the end. I look forward to talking to you soon.